The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Seeing Red Radio.
Truth is, there's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down, and the rich have won.
We carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations.
To protect the haves from the have-nots.
Freedom is a universal gift of Almighty God.
To maintain the security of those who accumulate wealth from the labor of others.
We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense.
To protect wealth from the poverty that wealth creates.
We will work with our friends and allies across the world to defend our way of life.
Corporate and political powers connive to keep wages down while shredding the worker's safety net.
A time comes when silence is betrayal.
Seeing Red Radio.
We can usher in a new era of enhanced prosperity and peace.
The great American wealth machine has been cranking out jackpots for the people at the top.
America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace.
And pushing working people further down the ladder.
Did our generation advance the cause of freedom?
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land. That it should be a collective ownership.
That time has come for us.
There comes a time when the operation of the machine is so odious.
I have been proud to be a part of a strong bipartisan consensus.
That you cannot even tacitly participate. You've got to place your bodies on the gears, the wheels, all the mechanism, and you've got to indicate to those who own it and those who run it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Building a wall between friends, a wall that justifies any means for their ends, a wall between Semites, rich and poor, brothers and sisters from not so long before, many feet thick and 20 feet high. No one can look through it and into the eye of a person you might know, to whom you might confide. Now just a stranger on the other side. They're building a wall between water and land, so we can eat fruit and they can eat sand. A wall to make sure that our orchards will grow and our kids can get fat and not need to know of the cities in ruins and the children in fear that your fathers and brothers in tanks might be near. A wall to keep quiet that which you fear most, so you don't have to listen to your grandfather's ghost. They're building a wall between future and past, a wall to keep separate the chambers of gas from bulldozers, gunships, and the tears of a child. Dignity, love, and honor defiled. To remove reality from your facts on the ground. A wall to keep distant the terrible sound of the houses that crumble and the children that die. A wall to keep separate the truth from the lie. They're building a wall, and at such a cost. Land, money, and safety, and all the lives lost. A wall made of brick, but bricks can be broken when the people of Zion have finally awoken and said no more walls, no more refugees, no more keeping people up on their knees. And then the history books will someday recall, before apartheid was ended, they were building a wall.
David Rovics. They're building a wall. Israel's brutal rampage in the Gaza in December and January claimed the lives of more than 1,300 Palestinians, the majority of them unarmed civilians, according to the Israeli human rights organization Beit Salem. But the assault may also have claimed another victim, the viability of the so-called two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. For several decades, the conventional wisdom has been that peace in the Middle East can only be achieved by establishing a Palestinian mini-state in Gaza and the West Bank alongside Israel. But it has become clear to a growing number of Israelis and Palestinians that this idea will never become a reality, and that the only remaining solution is a single state in the whole of historic Palestine, with equal rights for all of its citizens. The future of the two-state solution was explored in an unusually candid and remarkably even-handed segment of the CBS News program 60 Minutes in January, just days after Israel had finally declared a ceasefire in Gaza. The program on the growth of Israel's illegal settlements in the West Bank, which are now home to almost 300,000 Israelis. The settlements have expanded with the tacit approval of successive Israeli governments, who at the same time have been engaged in a never-ending quote-unquote peace process with the supposed goal of establishing a Palestinian state. But as CBS correspondent Bob Simon pointed out in that 60 Minutes program,
"But while negotiations have been going on for 15 years, hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers have moved in to occupy the West Bank. Palestinians say they can't have a state with Israeli settlers all over it, which the settlers say is precisely the idea."
The 60 Minutes report was one of the few occasions, perhaps the only occasion, that the reality of the more than 40-year Israeli occupation of the West Bank has been shown on primetime TV in the United States. And as Bob Simon noted,
"Palestinians had hoped to establish their state here on the West Bank, an area the size of Delaware. But Israelis have sliced it up with scores of settlements and hundreds of miles of new highways that only settlers can use. Palestinians have to drive or ride on the older roads. When they want to travel from one town to another, they have to submit to humiliating delays at checkpoints and roadblocks. There are more than 600 of them on the West Bank."
From Deputy Mayor of Jerusalem, Meron Benvenisti, a well-known Israeli dove, admitted in an interview that the settlements have made a two-state solution unworkable.
"The geopolitical condition that's been created in 67 is irreversible. Cannot be changed. You cannot unscramble that egg."
The program even raised the unthinkable issue of whether Israel has constructed a new form of apartheid in the occupied territory.
"Apartheid? Israel is building what it calls a security wall between the West Bank and Israel. The Palestinians are furious because it appropriates 8% of the West Bank. Not only that, it weaves its way through Palestinian farms, separating farmers from their land. They have to wait at gates for soldiers to let them in. Settlers get a lot more water than Palestinians, which is why settlements are green and Arab areas are not."
Veterans of the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, like Archbishop Desmond Tutu, have not been reticent about drawing parallels with the current situation in the occupied territories. According to Tutu, quote, "Yesterday's South African township dwellers can tell you about today's life in the occupied territories. To travel only blocks in his own homeland, a Palestinian grandfather waits on the whim of a teenage Israeli soldier. More than an emergency is needed to get to a hospital, less than a crime earns a trip to jail. The lucky ones have a permit to leave their squalor to work in Israel's cities, but their luck runs out when security closes all checkpoints, paralyzing an entire people. The indignities, dependence, and anger are all too familiar," end quote. Even some prominent Israelis agree that the comparison with South African apartheid is apt. Ami Ayalon, for example, the former head of Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, admits that Israel has created a system with, quote, "apartheid characteristics that is not compatible with Jewish principles," end quote. But it is not just the situation in the West Bank or Gaza that can be criticized in this way. 20% of Israel's own population consists of Palestinian Arabs who have been treated as, at best, second-class citizens ever since the Zionist state was established. Israeli Jews have exclusive use of most of the country's land, privileged access to private and public employment, special educational loans and home mortgages, and preferences for admission to universities. Other special privileges are reserved for those who have served in the Israeli military, from which Israeli Arabs are excluded. Meanwhile, the poverty rate for Israeli Arabs is double that for Jews, and the Israeli government spends much more on schools, hospitals, roads, and other social services in Jewish areas than an Arab. And while Jews from any part of the world have the right to become Israeli citizens, Israeli Arabs, who marry Palestinians from the occupied territories, are not even permitted to live with their spouses in Israel itself. We've been listening to an article by Phil Gasper entitled The Return of the One-State Solution, The Case for a Single Democratic Secular State in Historic Palestine. And we were featuring some excerpts from the 60 Minutes special that was aired back in January. Right now we're going to return to another segment from that program, and then we'll return to Phil Gasper. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back.
Why do the Israelis have so many checkpoints?
I think the main goal is to fragment the West Bank. Maybe a little bit of them can be justified because they say it's for security, but I think the vast majority of them are basically to block the movement of people from one place to another.
Here's how they block Dr. Barghouti. He was born in Jerusalem, grew up in Jerusalem, and worked in a hospital there for 14 years. 4 years ago, he moved to a town just 10 miles away. But now, because he no longer lives in Jerusalem, he can't get back in, ever.
Now, 1 minute. You cannot go to Jerusalem?
At all.
Can't you get a permit to go?
I asked for a permit to go to Jerusalem during the last year, the last 2 years, about 16 times. And 16 times they were rejected. Like most Palestinians, I don't have a permit to go to the city I was born in, to the city I used to work in, to the city where my sister lives.
Here's what he's up against. Scores of Israeli settlements dominating the lowlands like crusader fortresses. Many are little cities, and none of them existed 40 years ago. The Israelis always take the high ground, sometimes the hills, sometimes the homes, and sometimes Arabs are occupied inside their own homes. This house, for example, the highest house on the highest hill overlooking the town of Nablus. We learned that Israeli soldiers often corral the four families who live here and take over the house to monitor movement down below.
We're going into an apartment owned by Mr. Nassif here in Nablus. We understand that Israeli soldiers came in this morning and, without any notice, without any invitation, came into the apartment and have been there ever since.
We cannot speak with you. There is a soldier.
They're soldiers?
Yes.
What are they doing here?
We are prison here.
What's happening?
They are keeping here, and the soldiers are upstairs. We cannot move. We cannot speak with you.
You can't leave the house?
No.
They told you that?
Yes. I can't breathe.
How long are they going to stay?
I don't know.
Are they paying you any money?
You are kidding.
I'm kidding.
Abdel Nassif, the bank manager, said he had to get to his bank to open the safe, but that soldiers won't let him go. He told us when the soldiers come, they wake everybody up and herd them into a kitchen for hours while soldiers sleep in their bedrooms. They can't leave or use the phone or let us in. He sent us downstairs to see if his brother would open the door so we could ask the soldiers why they keep taking over this house.
You want to come?
Yes. Just open the door and then...
The soldiers closed the door from the keys. They take the keys.
So we left, and that night, so did the soldiers. But when we returned 2 days later, the soldiers were back for more surveillance. This time, they kept the women under house arrest, but let the men go to work and the children go to school. When the children returned, we caught a glimpse of two armed soldiers at the top of the stairs. Then more children came home, but the soldiers wouldn't open the door again.
They say if you don't go back behind the wall, the children will not enter the house.
But this is where the children live.
Yeah, but you need to go away from the door so I can let the children come in, okay?
Who are you?
He's a commander here.
He's a commander here?
Yeah.
Can we talk to you?
No.
Well, we're talking to you now. Why don't you tell us what you're doing here? Have you lost your voice? Well, they've closed the door now. They've closed the window. So I guess if the children are going to get home, we have to leave. So that's what we'll do. An army spokesman told us the soldiers use the Nassif's house for important surveillance operations. The Nassif's told us the soldiers usually stay for a day or two, always coming and going in the middle of the night. When they do go, the Nassif's never know when they'll be occupied again. It could be tomorrow, next week, or next month. The only certainty, they say, is that the soldiers will be back.
Ultimately, the failure of the two-state solution is rooted in the way in which Israel was created. The nature of the state that was founded and the role that it has played since that time. From its inception in the late 19th century, the Zionist movement wanted to create not just a homeland for Jews in Palestine, but an exclusively Jewish state in which Jews would have privileged status. Zionism was, of course, a response to widespread anti-Semitism in Europe, but it was a response that was itself rooted in European colonial traditions that ignored the rights and sometimes even the humanity of the indigenous Palestinian population. Thus, the myth was created of a land without a people for a people without a land, when the reality was that a large Palestinian Arab population had lived in the region for at least 1,000 years. The Zionist, quote-unquote, solution to this reality was to plan the dispossession of the Palestinians. As Joseph Welz, the head of the Jewish Agency's colonization department, put it in his private diary, quote, "Between ourselves, there is no room for both peoples together in this country, and there is no other way than to transfer the Arabs from here to the neighboring countries, to transfer all of them. Not one village, not one tribe should be left. Only after this transfer will the country be able to absorb the millions of our own brethren," end quote. This was the logic that was largely put into effect when Israel was founded in 1948. Close to 800,000 Palestinians were driven from their homes into refugee camps in Gaza, the West Bank, and surrounding Arab countries, and hundreds of their villages were destroyed. The establishment of Israel is often justified as a response to the Nazi Holocaust, in which nearly 6 million European Jews were killed. The Holocaust was the greatest act of barbarism in the 20th century. But how could the suffering of European Jews give them the right to expel Palestinians from their own land? The oppression of one people, however brutal, does not give them the right to oppress others. Yet that, sadly, is what the Israeli state did to the Palestinians. Israel was founded not only on the dispossession of the Palestinians, but also on the basis of a conscious strategy of courting support from the biggest imperialist powers. In the 1920s and the 1930s, when Britain controlled Palestine, the Zionists offered their services to crush the Palestinian anti-colonial movement. After Israel was founded, it offered its services to the West as its proxy to the oil-rich Middle East. Following the 1967 Six-Day War, in which Israel launched a supposedly preemptive attack on its Arab neighbors, easily defeated them, and occupied Gaza and the West Bank, it cemented a strategic alliance with the United States, which has lasted until today. The United States gives Israel billions of dollars of aid every year, and in return, gets a watchdog for its interests in the region. As the late Democratic Senator Henry Scoop Jackson noted back in 1973, Israel, quote, "served to inhibit and contain those irresponsible and radical elements in certain Arab states who, were they free to do so, pose a grave threat indeed to our principal sources of petroleum in the Persian Gulf," end quote. Zionist ideology and Israel's role as an imperialist proxy in the Middle East have made it an expansionary and militaristic state from its inception. It has never been able to countenance the existence of a genuinely independent Palestinian state on its border, since this would reduce its ability to project its power throughout the region. Israel's far right, represented by the Likud party, maintains the fantasy that it can expel the remaining Palestinian population from the West Bank and expand Greater Israel to the River Jordan. More moderate leaders in Kadima and the Labour Party are willing to give Palestinians local control over a fragmented collection of South African-style Bantustans, while Israel maintains effective control of the West Bank and continues to blockade Gaza. We'll be right back. Let's return with another great song by David Rovix called The Key, right here on Seeing Red Radio.
Let me tell you about a lady known as Grandma to me. She died back in 1982. She liked to tell stories of how things used to be, just like other old ladies do. She talked about her neighbors, Muslims and Christians, Arabs, Britons, and Jews. They'd come over for dinner in her house in Jaffa. They'd talk about business and news. We got along fine a long time ago, before everything started to change. I never imagined back in those days I'd end up here on this firing range. There on a string around her neck, dangling in front of her heart, the key to her home, the key to her people, the key to her world, blown apart. I recall the days well, 1948, the year of the catastrophe. With machine guns and torches, they drove us away to the land of the refugee. We all thought it would pass, but the decades dragged on, and my heart turned to flame. To those who live in my home, where is your conscience? Do you feel the remorse and the shame? There on a string around her neck, dangling in front of her heart, the key to her home, the key to her people, the key to her world, blown apart. Generations, I and her grandchildren say, the key is theirs and mine. And all over the world, we cry for Al-Auda, home in Palestine. Maybe we will prevail, but come what may, as empires fall and rise, nothing will change the memory of the tears in my grandmother's eyes. there on a string around her neck, dangling in front of her heart. The key to her home, the key to her people, the key to her world. Blown.
David Rovics with The Key. David has just so many great songs, period, but specifically about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's almost tempting to just to stop talking and let him speak, or sing, as it were. But let's return back to that article by Phil Gasper, Return of the One-State Solution, The Case for a Single Democratic Secular State in Historic Palestine. A one-state solution is certainly not a new idea. For decades, the goal of a unitary, democratic, and secular state in the whole of historic Palestine, with guaranteed equal rights for members of all religious, ethnic, and national groups, was the official position of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. The Palestinian Liberation Organization, also known as the PLO, began to move away from this position in the 1970s, and in practice, came to accept the idea of a Palestinian mini-state in Gaza and the West Bank is more realistic. This position was cemented as official policy with the signing of the Oslo Accords in 1973. In exchange for the PLO's recognition of Israel, a newly constituted Palestinian authority was given municipal powers in Gaza and a handful of towns in the West Bank. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation and settlement of the territories continued, and the status of Jerusalem and of Palestinian refugees outside the territories was left to future negotiations. It was a humiliating agreement for the PLO, which effectively turned it into a police force with the role of disciplining its own population. The Palestinian-American intellectual Edward Said commented at the time, quote, "The PLO has transformed itself from a national liberation movement into a kind of small town government with the same handful of people in command," end quote. It has been the complete failure of this so-called quote-unquote peace process that has led to the rise of Hamas and renewed support for the idea of a binational state. Last September, Britain's Guardian newspaper reported that a report issued by the Palestinian Strategy Study Group, quote, written by 27 leading Palestinian figures from across the political spectrum, argues for ending the negotiation process that has gone on now for nearly 20 years, reconstituting the Palestinian Authority into what might become a Palestinian Resistance Authority, and adopting a single state outcome as the Palestinians' preferred goal, end quote. The same month, the Toronto Star's Middle East correspondent noted that, quote, "The notion of a single binational state for Arabs and Jews has experienced something of a revival among Palestinians, most notably when Sari Nusabe, a respected intellectual and president of Al-Quds University in East Jerusalem, spoke favorably about the concept in a lengthy interview with the Israeli newspaper," end quote. In December, the respected Palestinian writer Gada Carmi argued, quote, "The peace process predicated on the two-state solution is stagnant, and a momentum has started towards the obvious alternative, a unitary state," end quote. In late March, an international conference to discuss the one-state solution was held at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. There is also a tradition among some anti-Zionist Jews supporting the idea of a singular secular state. In the 1920s, Judah Magnus, the founder of Hebrew University, advocated the creation of a binational state with equal rights for Jews and Arabs instead of a Jewish state. Quote, "If as a minority we insist upon keeping the other man from achieving just aims," he wrote, "and if we keep him from this with the aid of bayonets, we must not be surprised if we are attacked, and what is wrong, if moral degeneration sets in among us." In the 1930s and 1940s, socialists like the Palestinian Jew Yigiel Gluckenstein, who later wrote under the name Tony Cliff, advocated unity between Arab and Jewish workers. More recently, the Israeli peace activist Miko Peled has argued, quote, only full equal rights for both people in their historic homeland will bring an end to this conflict, end quote. The Israeli-American journalist Nir Rosen has expressed the same idea, quote, what needs to happen at this point is a one-state solution where Palestinian refugees are allowed to go back to their homes, where Israel is a state for Jews and non-Jews alike, a state for its citizens, end quote. Most Israeli politicians are today obsessed by the so-called demographic problem. Even if a two-state solution were to be instituted tomorrow, the Palestinian and non-Jewish population within Israel itself is growing so fast that it will constitute a majority of the population within a few decades. That leaves Israel with only three alternatives: massive ethnic cleansing of non-Jews, the imposition of even more brutal forms of apartheid, or the abandonment of the idea of a Jewish state. For activists who reject the first two options, the best model remains the struggle that ended apartheid in South Africa. Boycotts, divestment, and sanctions from the outside world helped end South Africa's institutional racism. Similar campaigns are needed today to help end Israel's repression of the Palestinians and to win a single state with equal rights for all. You've been listening to an article entitled Return of the One-State Solution, The Case for a Single Democratic Secular State in Historic Palestine, written by Phil Gasper, who's the editor of the Communist Manifesto, a roadmap to history's most important document, available from Haymarket Books. He's also a member of the International Socialist Review Editorial Board, and you can find that, in fact, in the March-April edition of this year of the International Socialist Review. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. We'll be right back. The Cobra Skulls with Cobra Acoustic on Seeing Red Radio. On Capitol Hill, labor law experts and a California worker exposed the ugly truth about corporate abuses of workers trying to exercise their freedom to form unions and bargain for a better life. At the center of the discussion, Kate Broffenbrenner's new report, quote, "No Holds Barred, The Intensification of Employer Opposition to Organizing," end quote, released by the Economic Policy Institute and the American Rights at Work Education Fund. The report shows that the problems the Employee Free Choice Act would address are getting worse. Broffenbrenner has studied these issues for decades as the Director of Labor Education Research at Cornell's University School of Industrial Relations. This is her fourth survey over 20 years, enabling her to put into historical perspective the obstacles workers face today. At the Capitol Hill briefing, Broffenbrenner said weak laws and a hostile environment have emboldened corporations over the past decade to step up their abuses against workers trying to form unions. The research provides a detailed portrait of a system that has failed private sector workers. Workers have come to understand what the data confirms. Employers are using an arsenal of legal and illegal tactics to interfere with workers trying to organize, and they are doing it with impunity. The study is the result of an in-depth examination of National Labor Relations Board documents, examination of companies, interviews with workers, and investigations of unfair labor practice filings to give a clear picture of what the process of forming a union really looks like. And it's not pretty. 63% of companies have supervisors interrogate workers in mandatory one-on-one meetings. 57% of companies threaten workers with plant closings. 47% threaten to cut wages and benefits. What's more, even if they win representation, a majority of workers still don't have a first contract after a whole year. Angel Warner, a working mom from California, offered a compelling story of these coercive tactics in action. Warner is a warehouse worker for Rite Aid who tried to form a union through the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU. At a large warehouse with 600 workers. The warehouse was inadequately heated in the winter and cooled in the summer, and the work was difficult and at times unsafe. That's why Warner and her co-workers hoped to form a union. Wages and benefits were an issue, she said, but not the only issue. Mostly they were concerned about job security and improving safety on the job, especially after management imposed a quota system that encouraged unsafe behavior. You walk a fine line of taking a trip to the hospital. We like our jobs. We just want dignity, respect, and a voice in our workplace. A person can only take so much. We decided it was time to stand up for ourselves. Warner said that as she and her co-workers tried to form a union, management pulled union supporters aside for threatening meetings and singled out potential supporters for harassment. Pro-union employees were fired, and the workers filed 49 labor law violations against Rite Aid. But the only repercussion for Rite Aid is having to rehire employees, two employees and post flyers saying they would no longer engage in unfair practices. Warner and her co-workers won the election by only a handful of votes, even after getting two-thirds of the employees to sign up because of the extended election period and the abuses by management during that time. The election was held 2 years after starting the process of gathering signatures, Warner said, and even after a year of having won a union, the company still hasn't offered a contract. Our labor laws are not working. They're not protecting the working class. We played by the rules. Even after harassment and threats, we voted for a union, and yet we're still working without a contract. People are terrified of losing their jobs. It's put such a psychological and emotional pressure on you. It's hard to function in the workplace because you're so scared. You walk through the door and you don't know, is this going to be the day that I walk out with my pink slip? We have responsibilities to our families, our children. The working class needs help. We're tired of waiting for justice. I urge senators and congresspeople that are on the fence or have changed their minds to look at people like me and the people I work with and the thousands like me because we're not unique. Workers' rights need to be upheld. We're ready to stand up for ourselves. Fred Feinstein, a former National Labor Relations Board counsel and a University of Maryland professor, agrees that existing labor law isn't protecting workers. Warner's story isn't an exception, Feinstein said. It's one vivid example of a pervasive failure of labor law. Quote, There's room for better enforcement and better strategies, but the law itself is defective. There's considerable evidence that over the last decades, new tactics have been developed, weaknesses in the law have been discovered, refined, and more successfully exploited so that conditions on the ground have changed. We need to change the legal framework if we're going to protect people. Extended delay is a powerful weapon for employers, Feinstein said, because it ensures years of litigation to prevent remedies for their misbehavior. And as the Economic Policy Institute President Larry Michel, that isn't just as an issue of fairness, it's an economic issue. We've seen a 30-year period of rising inequality that didn't allow people to have a good paycheck, he notes, which has undermined our economy by cutting back on workers' purchasing power and security. As we rebuild the economy, we need to make sure it's on a strong foundation. One clear foundation is to fix the fundamentally broken labor market system. We have an economy that has been producing higher productivity, but most workers haven't been able to benefit. Companies are trying to preempt union campaigns, targeting union supporters, and interrogating workers to find out how they're going to vote. Yes, that's the reality of the quote-unquote secret ballot corporate lobbies are trying to impose. Corporate tactics are designed to make the process less secret and less secure for workers who hope to join unions. Increasingly, management is working to monitor and punish union activities and force workers to choose sides. Says Bronfenbrenner, quote, "We found a climate of employer opposition that revealed a clear pattern of interrogation and surveillance, followed by threats and harassment to make sure that workers who pursue a union do so at clear personal risk." Bronfenbrenner said that although she studied many unfair labor practice filings, many abuses aren't even reported because a climate of fear, weak remedies, and long delays prevent workers from protesting unfair practices. Warner said the common corporate complaint that workers could act coercively as they campaigned to get their coworkers to form a union was laughable and unsupported by the facts. From a worker's point of view, the harassment and intimidation I've seen has come from the company's side, says Bronfenbrenner. She and Feinstein both agreed that decades of research into researching campaigns shows this to be the case across the board. Historically, the number of unfair labor practice filings against unions is extremely low. Only 42 cases of misconduct over 7 decades. While there are nearly 30,000 unfair labor practices against workers by companies every year. Hold a moment, that just bears repeating. Remember, unfair labor practice filings against unions is so low that they've only found 42 cases of misconduct over 7 decades, 70 whole years, while there are nearly 30,000 unfair labor practices against workers by companies every single year. People who say both sides are at fault aren't to be taken seriously. Bronfenbrenner said, quote, "Unions wouldn't function if workers were coerced. The whole idea of having a union, of the organizing process, relies on workers feeling they have a democratic process and believing in their union. Workers can vote their way out of a union at many phases. You don't get to vote against your boss, and employers have enormous power over workers. They can fire you. They control your schedule, your pay, and your working conditions." What an incredible argument for the Employee Free Choice Act. That's an article written by Seth Michaels on the AFL-CIO blog. You can find it, entitled "Workers Face Increasing Abuse in Attempts to Form Unions" on the PWW.org website. That's the People's Weekly World. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. With what time that is left, we're going to talk about this day in a revolutionary history right here on Seeing Red Radio.
A long time ago, I was sitting in a cafe in Worcester, Massachusetts, called Alice in the Hat. And there was a fellow sitting next to me. I was working for the Laborers Union. They were doing a labor education program. And the television set was on, and Cesar Chavez was on the evening news leading that first big march in Sacramento. And this fellow who had been holding his union card for 26 years said, "Bunch of wetbacks, why don't they ship back to Mexico, taking jobs away from American workers?" And I could have got mad. Then I had to stop and think, well, what did he get in school? What did he get in his work experience? You know, what did he get even from his own union that gave him some tools to understand what it was he was seeing on that television? If he had grown up with the true and sure knowledge of who he was and where he had come from, he would have been a whole lot more pissed off than he was, and he'd have known exactly who to be pissed off at, too, I'll tell you that. Well, that's why we do these songs. These songs are a better and more accurate picture, idea of who we are and where we have come from the best damn history book that you ever read, you know? And like Claire Sparks said, a radical feminist in Southern California, said, the long memory is the most radical idea in America. Would you have freedom from wage slavery? Then come join the grand industrial band. Would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do your share, lend a hand. There is power, there is power.
Mansions of gold in the sky and live in a shack way in the back. Would you have wings up in heaven to fly and stay here with rags on your back?
There is power in a hand of working folk when they stand.
Of the blood of the lamb, then come join the grand industrial band. If for a change you'd have eggs and ham, come on, do your share, lend a hand.
There is power in a band of working folk when they stand.
Sluggers to beat on your heads, then don't organize, all unions despise. If you'd have nothing before you're dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise.
There is power in a band of working folks when they stand.
Man, come on, do your share, lend a hand.
There is power in a band of working folks when they stand hand in hand. That's the power that must rule every land, for industrial union grand.
All right. Today is the 21st of May, and we're going to look back on this particular day to remember, first and foremost, the Paris Commune. You know, years ago when I became radically minded, I looked at, was examining history and discovered this occurrence that somehow, you know, historians had sort of kept from me all of this time. It not infrequently happens when you become a socialist or a communist or a Marxist, whatnot. You sort of look back and go, wait a minute. But the Paris Commune was a government that very briefly ruled Paris from March 28th to May 28th of 1871, hailed, and rightfully so, as the very first assumption of power by the working class. In a formal sense, the Paris Commune was simply the local authority, the city council in French, the commune, which exercised power in Paris for 2 months in the spring of 1871. However, the conditions in which it was formed, its controversial decrees, and its tortured end makes its tenure one of the more important political episodes of the time. The Commune was the result of an uprising in Paris after France was defeated in the Franco-Prussian War. This uprising was chiefly caused by the disaster in the war and the growing discontent among French workers. The worker discontent can be traced to the very first worker uprisings, the Canut revolts in Lyon and Paris in the 1830s. A Canut was a Lyonnais silk worker, often working on Jacquard looms. Parisians, especially workers in the lower middle classes, had long supported a democratic republic. A specific demand was that Paris should be self-governing with its own elected council, something enjoyed by smaller French towns, but denied to Paris by a national government wary of the capital's unruly populace. An associated but less well articulated wish was for a more just, if not necessarily socialist, way of managing the economy, summed up in the popular appeal for a democratic and social republic. The war with Prussia, initiated by Napoleon III in July of 1870, turned out disastrously for France, and by September, Paris itself was under siege. The gap between the rich and the poor in the capital of Paris had widened during the preceding years, and then food shortages, military failures, and finally a Prussian bombardment of the city contributed to a widespread discontent. In January of 1871, after 4 months of siege, the moderate Republican government of national defense sought an armistice with the newly proclaimed German Empire. The Germans included a triumphal entry into Paris in their peace terms. Despite the hardships of the siege, many Parisians were bitterly resentful of the Prussians, now at the head of the German Empire, being allowed even a brief ceremonial occupation of their city. Hundreds of thousands of Parisians were armed members of a civilians militia known as the National Guard, which had been greatly expanded to help defend the city. Guard units elected their own officers, who in working-class districts included radical and socialist leaders. Steps were taken to form a central committee of the Guard, including patriotic Republicans and socialists, both to defend Paris against a possible German attack and also to defend the Republic against a possible royalist restoration. The election of a monarchist majority to the new National Assembly in February of 1871 made such fears seem plausible. The population of Paris was defiant in the face of defeat and prepared to fight if the entry of the German army into the city should provoke them sufficiently. Before German troops entered Paris, National Guardsmen, helped by ordinary working people, managed to move large numbers of cannons, which they regarded as their own property because they had been partly paid for by public subscription, away from the Germans' path and store them in safe districts. One of the chief cannon parks was on the heights of Montmartre. Adolf Thiers, head of the new provisional national government, realized that in the current unstable situation, the Central Committee of the Guard formed an alternative center of political and military power. He was also concerned that workers would arm themselves with National Guard's weapons and provoke the Germans. The Germans entered Paris briefly, left again without incident, but Paris continued to be in a state of high political excitement. The imperial and provisional governments had both left Paris for Versailles, a safer haven against the German armies, and during the time required to return there was a power vacuum in the capital of France. As the Central Committee of the National Guard adopted an increasingly radical stance and steadily gained authority, the government felt that it could not indefinitely allow it to have 400 cannons at its disposal. So, as a first step, on March 18th, Thiers ordered regular troops to seize the cannons stored on the Butte Montmartre and in other locations across the city. But instead, the soldiers, whose morale was low, fraternized with National Guards and local residents. The general at Montmartre, Claude Martin Lecomte, who was later said to have ordered them to fire on the crowd of National Guards and civilians, was dragged from his horse, later shot together with General Thomas, a veteran Republican now hated as a former commander of the National Guard, who was seized nearby. Other army units joined the rebellion, which spread so fast that the head of the government, Thiers, ordered an immediate evacuation of Paris by as many of the regular forces as would obey, by the police and by administrators and specialists of every kind. He fled ahead of them to Versailles. Thiers claimed he had thought about the strategy to retreat from Paris to crush the insurrection afterwards for a long time while meditating on the example of the 1848 revolution, but it is just as likely that he panicked. There's no evidence that the government had expected or planned for the crisis that had now begun. The Central Committee of the National Guard was now the only effective government in Paris. It arranged elections for a commune to be held on March 26th. The 92 members of the communal council included a high proportion of skilled workers and several professionals such as doctors and journalists. Many of them were political activists ranging from reformist Republicans through various types of socialists to the Jacobins, who tended to look back nostalgically to the revolution of 1789. But what we're remembering today while we speak of that Paris commune was the Semaine Sanglante. Excuse my French, it's clearly awful. On this day, in 1821, began the Bloody Week. Marshal MacCannon had issued a proclamation. To the inhabitants of Paris, the French army has come to save you. Paris is freed. At 4 o'clock, our soldiers took the last insurgent position. Today, the fight is over. Order, work, and security will be reborn, end quote. Reprisals now began in earnest. Having supported the commune in any way was a political crime of which thousands could be and were accused. Some of the communards were shot against what is now known as the Communards Wall in the Père-Lachaise Cemetery, while thousands of others were tried by summary courts-martial of doubtful legality, and thousands were shot. Notorious sites of slaughter were the Luxembourg Gardens and the Lubau Barracks behind the Hôtel de Ville. Nearly 40,000 others were marched to Versailles for trials. For many days, endless columns of men and women and children made a painful way under military escort to temporary prison quarters in Versailles. Later, 12,500 were tried, and about 10,000 were found guilty. 23 men were executed. Many were condemned to prison. 4,000 were deported for life to New Caledonia. The number killed during La Semaine Sanglante can never be established for certain, and estimates range from about 10,000 to 50,000. According to Benedict Anderson, 7,500 were jailed or deported, and roughly 20,000 were executed. That began on this day, May 21st in 1871. And it's a good thing to remember, because sometimes when you're talking to individuals about what revolution is about, oftentimes people say, oh, revolution, it's bloody. It's a great Malcolm X speech, in fact, where he says that very thing. You know, you don't get bloodless revolutions. Though a clear argument can be made that the October Revolution of 1917, the actual revolution that brought the Bolsheviks to power, was almost virtually bloodless. So weakened was the provisional government that the Soviets easily took control. The working class rarely, you know, you look at the revolution of 1789 in Paris and about the guillotines and the pools of blood, and you always hear about what working class people will do when they rise up, and they'll just kill all the rich people and blood in the streets, and it'll be awful. But history has shown us that the real bloody murderers of history, not the working class. No, time and time again, the ruling class has found its enemies, tortured them, deported them, killed them outright. That's history. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. I want to feature a little mix I put together, and I featured on the show a few weeks ago, but it's great to have it returned. It's featuring the great Fred Hampton, the late Black Panther leader. It's a mix I call Freddy Ain't Dead.
We might not be back. I might be in jail. I might be anywhere. But when I leave, you remember I said, with the last words on my lips, that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that.
Gonna make the world safe for democracy, aren't you?
What is democracy?
Well, that's never very clear on itself. Like every other kind of government, it's got something to do with young men killing each other.
Why don't old men kill each other?
Well, the old men are needed to keep the home first.
Couldn't the young men do that just as well?
Young men don't have homes. That's why they must go out and kill each other.
When it comes to my turn, will you want me to go?
For democracy.
For democracy.
Any man would give his only begotten son.
Bloody good bunch of killers.
We ain't different. Whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow.
If we are going to have to fight, we're going to have to struggle. We're going to have to struggle religiously.
We ain't different. Whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow.
To bring about the peace, because the people that we're asking for peace, they're a bunch of megalomaniac warmongers, and they don't even understand what peace means.
We ain't different. Whether he be white, black, brown, or yellow.
I've heard several comments from people that were talking about just the people, for the people, and by the people. Being a black woman from Mississippi, I've learned that long ago that's not true. It's with a handful, by a handful, by a handful. But we don't change that, baby. We are going to change that because we're going to make democracy a reality for all of the people of this country. Because when we start saying the war is wrong in Vietnam, while people looked at us like we were something out of space. But when they talked about the other day of the Gallup poll being 58% of the people against the war in Vietnam, then we see if you're right, you have to stand on that principle, and if it's necessary to die on the principle, because I am sick of the racist war in Vietnam when we don't have justice in the United States.
We move to a high level. We're moving to a level whereby the people are going to take over control of their destiny. They're going to take over control of their community. And the first way of doing this is dealing with the most integral part of the fascist three-way oppression. We say demagogic lying politicians and avaricious greedy businessmen. And we say fascist pig cops. But the one that's most evident, the one that's closest, the one that's more clear, the one that's more defined in the black community is those fascist pig cops. So what we are saying is, if the people can deal with these fools, we would have taken a revolutionary step, a revolutionary leap, I should say. So that's the program that we think is going to move things to a high level. It's going to raise some contradictions. It's going to cause some antagonistic contradictions. We're prepared to deal with them, and we think the people are prepared to deal with them.
Freddie Ain't Dead right here on Seeing Red Radio, featuring the voices of the late, great Fred Hampton and Fannie Lou Hamer. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote just yesterday in a story that 27 former justices and prosecutors are now asking the U.S. Supreme Court to allow death row inmate Troy Davis's innocence claims to be heard in federal court. The filing comes a day after Davis's lawyers filed their final legal bid. They are asking the nation's highest court to send Davis's case back so a judge can consider the recantation testimony of a number of key witnesses who testified for the state at the 1991 trial. Davis sits on death row for the killing of off-duty Savannah police officer Mark Allen McPhail in 1989. McPhail, a 27-year-old father of two and former U.S. Army Ranger, was shot before he could draw his weapon. Davis can make, quote, an extraordinary showing through new, never-reviewed evidence that strongly points to his innocence, the judges and prosecutors filing said. To allow Davis's execution without appropriate legal review is, quote, a plain constitutional injustice, the filing said. Among those signing the friend of court brief were former Deputy U.S. Attorney General Larry Thompson, two former state Supreme Court Chief Justices, including Norman Fletcher of Georgia, nine former U.S. attorneys, including former Georgia Congressman Bob Barr and former FBI Director William Sessions, three former judges from the Federal Appeals Court in Philadelphia, and former state attorneys general from Florida and New Jersey. In a 2-1 decision in April, the Federal Appeals Court in Atlanta rejected Davis's request for an evidentiary hearing. The court, which had postponed Davis's execution, extended the stay for 30 days. That expired last Saturday. Since Davis's trial, 7 of 9 state witnesses have recanted their testimony, and other witnesses have implicated Sylvester Red Coles as the shooter. Coles was at the scene and was the first person to implicate Troy Davis in the shooting. That's an article that just came out yesterday. And we got to support Troy Davis. Let them not kill another innocent African-American man in this prison system. We can, brothers and sisters. You're listening to Seeing Red. One of the things I talked about at the very beginning of the show, didn't get a chance to get into the desire of this program to go ahead and move into the discussion of revolutionary theory. And I think a place to begin is a document that Karl Marx wrote very early on in his life, at the age of 26. Of the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844 are in many ways his working out of what he saw as the genuine prescription for society's ills. And this is, of course, 4 years before he joined with Friedrich Engels to write the Communist Manifesto, decades before his masterwork, Das Kapital, which expanded a number of the concepts that he began discussing and elaborating in these documents when he was 26. It was never published until way after his death. In fact, not only after his death, but it wasn't published until well after the Russian Revolution. And I think if you take his words at their full value, you come to realize how many of the states and political parties who later went on to represent themselves as quote-unquote Marxist states were incredibly far from the mark. The point is, in about 2 more weeks. I'm going to devote a program to the book. And if you've not read it, I really welcome you to get online, because you don't even have to go out and find it. There's a number of great editions. Vintage put out a great edition entitled The Early Writings, and you can find it in there. But even if you don't want to purchase the book, Marxists.org. That's Marxist with, you know, plural, Marxists.org, also known as the Marxist Internet Archive, is unbelievable. Just about anything that you need to find in revolutionary theory is there. It's the Philosophical Economic Manuscripts of 1844. After the show is over, I'll be updating the website at seeingredradio.org, and I'll include all of the links there. We're going to educate ourselves in exactly what it is that is required to rid ourselves of capitalism in our time. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. Let's check out Bad Religion with Let Them Eat War right here on Seeing Red Radio.
Sociedad. 'Cause I know we're all part of the y agárrala.
Daniela Weiss moved from Israel to the West Bank 33 years ago. She's been the mayor of a large settlement.
I think that settlements prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state in the land of Israel. This is their goal and this is their reality.
I can't help it. I don't care how far you think the analogy extends itself. When I see you making that bus driver climb up and down, on and off the roof of his bus for your amusement for hours in the hot sun, I think of how we once had to dance and sing for them while they shot our parents. When I see you keep that woman and her husband at the checkpoint while she's in labor and you stand there, listening to her scream, watching as she gives birth on the backseat of a taxi, I think of the walls around our own ghetto and how we had to crawl through the sewers looking for rats to eat while we could hear their children playing on the other side. When I see you crush that house and kill that woman and her baby with your armored bulldozer because they didn't have a permit, I think of the way we were once forced to leave our homes at the point of a gun. And when I hear your general say that in order to deal with the Intifada, you must learn from the tactics of another general, one Mr. Stroop, in Warsaw, I think of how they bombed our buildings, shot us as we fell from the roofs. And I remember how we wished we could kill their babies, too. And I feel sick, sick of your displaced anger, sick of your self-deception, sick of your attempts to deceive the rest of the world, sick of your accusations of anti-Semitism, sick of your occupation, sick of your apartheid state, sick of Zionism. Because standing here in Auschwitz, Birkenau, and Warsaw, I see Jenin, Yaffa, and Rafah. And I think of our ancestors, the Jewish Palestinians, who spoke so eloquently in their Arabic language. But the dead cannot speak. And now I find myself again behind the wall of a ghetto, standing with millions of other Palestinians. And I find myself shouting, Thawra, Thawra, Hat al-Nasr, tomorrow in Jerusalem, al-Auda, return.
Dr. Mustafa Barghouti is a former candidate for Palestinian president.
While my heart still wants to believe that the two-state solution is possible, my brain keeps telling me the opposite because of what I see in terms of the building of settlements. So in a way, these settlers are destroying the potential peace for both people that would have been created if we had two-state solution.
Andy told us Israel's invasion of Gaza, all the death and destruction, convinces him that Israel does not want a two-state solution.
I am very worried that what Israel has done has furthered us much further from the possibility of two-state solution.
That's another segment from the quite revealing portrayal of life in the occupied territories presented by Bob Simon, journalist from 60 Minutes. Really amazing that something like this would actually crack the media wall that exists, frankly, where rarely are we here in the United States told the full truth of what's happening in Palestine. So check out the website at seeingredradio.org. We will feature a link to the YouTube recording of that particular segment. I featured a little bit of it, but it's quite revealing to see. You just, of course, heard some music by, well, going back a little bit, you heard another great track from the Cobra Skulls that followed the Bad Religion song, Let Them Eat War. The Cobra Skulls song was entitled Use Your Cobra Skulls. And we also featured David Rovix with Palestine and his song Return. Like I said before, he literally has quite a body of work about Palestine and about Israel, and his songs very typically hit that emotional core that I think it's always vital that we never lose touch of, exactly what's going on with the oppressed peoples of the world.
My daddy was an heir from Beersheba, a situation so unkind. My mama was a refugee from Ramallah, had to leave her land behind. I grew up in this refugee camp, in this unwelcome land. In this little parcel of Lebanon, we were dealt a losing hand. And then one day the soldiers came, a tired old refrain. I'll try to tell you what happened next, but there's no way to explain. The soldiers raped my mother, and they killed her dead, along with the rest of the Sotila camp, while I hid beneath my bed. I'm a wandering, no place to call my home, Palestine. All around the world I roam. My aunt came over from Jordan and brought me there to live. And together we've moved to half the world, but for peace, what I would give. In Beirut, Greece, and New York town, I've watched the world churn. But my home is Palestine, someday I will return. But I'm a wandering, no place to call my home. This is my situation here in the heart of the empire that sent the copters and bulldozers from Ramallah to a funeral pyre. You've heard my story, time will not allow. Soon my visa will expire. What will you do now? 'Cause I'm a wanderer. No place to call my home, Palestine. All around the world I roam.
Check out our website at seeingredradio.org. We do have a list of all the articles and all of the music that you hear in each episode of Seeing Red Radio. We currently have, as of today, 21 episodes that are available for you to download. Earlier, we discussed this particular day in revolutionary history. Back in 1871, of course, was the beginning of what is known as the Bloody Week in French history. The horrendous repression and butchery and the suppression of the Paris Commune began on this day in 1871. But other things occurred on this particular day in history. 1923 in Hamburg, we found the founding of the Congress of the Labor and Socialist International on this day. In 1934, the general strike by Teamsters Union in Minneapolis culminates on this day in a battle against business goons. One source for labor events this month also notes that police stormed striking truck drivers in Minneapolis and were attempting to prevent truck movement in the market area, possibly referring to what occurred on this day. That's on this day, May 21st, 1934, the general strike by Teamsters Union, the Teamsters in Minneapolis. It was also on this day that the Little Wagner Act, as it was called, was signed in Hawaii, guaranteeing pineapple and sugar workers in Hawaii the right to bargain collectively. Thank you. The workers, mainly Asian Americans, soon strike for higher wages and a 40-hour week. 28,000 striking laborers shut down 33 of Hawaii's 34 plantations. After a long and bitter 79-day strike, the workers win decisively. The first time in Hawaiian history, the employers have been unable to fracture sugar worker strikers into incohesive racial groups. It was on this day in 1946 that the U.S. government seized all the bituminous coal mines, hoping to break a coal miners' strike. The miners were on strike, continued to strike, and forced the government to grant demands the owners would not. But the miners struck again on November 20th of 1945, directly against the government. The government secured an injunction to prevent the strike, but they struck anyhow, and the Union of Mine Workers was fined $3.5 million. Truman, the president at the time, was quoted as saying, "We used the weapons that we had at hand in order to fight a rebellion against the government." Yeah. On this day, 1956, the very first aerial test of a hydrogen bomb makes Bikini Atoll unlivable. The first hydrogen fusion bomb dropped from an airplane explodes over Namu Atoll at the northwest edge of the Bikini Atoll. The fireball was 4 miles in diameter. It was designated as Cherokee as part of Operation Red Wing. CBS News reports in 60 Minutes that the former commander of the Soviet Union's defunct nuclear forces stated that at least 100 or more suitcase-sized nuclear bombs are unaccounted for. A former advisor to Russian President Boris Yeltsin, summoned to investigate controls on 142 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons produced by the KGB during the Cold War, was quoted as saying, "I won't say how many I think have gone missing. You will publish it and scare the whole world. It's a question of units, not dozens." Boy, that's a really. On this day, 1968, the Workers' Student Action Committee forms in the factories of Citroën, culminating in the Great May Days of 1968. And on the same day, in the same year, on this side of the pond, is the second mass arrest at Columbia University when 138 were arrested in the Hamilton 2 and bystanders. Meanwhile, police and helicopters were dropping tear gas on a University of California campus rally in Berkeley. Also in 1968, in Germany, the beginning of the occupations of the University of West Berlin, demanding university reform and in sympathy with the student occupations and demands in France and the United States and the whole wide world. On this day in 1971, members of the American India Movement occupy the Naval Air Station near Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And also on that same day, more than 170 protesters were arrested in Washington, D.C., as 7,000 rally against the war in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia. In 1978, 4,300 are rallying at the Bangor Naval Base, Washington, to protest against the nuclear sub, the USS Trident. It was also on this day that in 1979, that the San Francisco Bay agitprop group called the Union of Concerned Commies began in early of 1979 as a left libertarian intervention into the anti-nuke movement, then at the height of its strength and militancy. This intervention involved a serious attempt to present a radical critique with attention-grabbing style and innovative use of media. For instance, cartoon graphics appeared on leaflets and posters and T-shirts distributed at anti-nuclear events. Some of the Union of Concerned Commies settled in for a sustained effort within the movement, mostly through the Abalone Alliance newspaper entitled It's About Times. And on this day in 1980, President Carter announces a state of emergency, the Love Canal, one of the worst industrial waste dumps here in the United States. And in 1981, the Senate approved a $20 billion program to return U.S. to the full-scale production of chemical and nerve gas weapons, also known, of course, as the weapons of mass destruction. That's all on this day in history, May 21st. You're listening to Seeing Red Radio.
When the people leave, the leaders they will have to follow. Their lies and their alibis they will have to swallow. And it's you that has the authority. For the one who is right is the majority. Yes, when the people leave, people
children, you got to take your leave, or you shall be led astray. So as long as someone else controls your history, the truth, it shall remain just. Not make him think when the people leave. People take the lead. Children, you got to take your leave, or you shall be led astray. Watch them try to hide this world's imposition, but like disease that has come round from remission, and when it seems as if it has left your person, all the while, Lord, it has haunted your son. When the people leave, people take your leave. People take the leave. People take the leave. People take the leave. People take the leave. Children, you got to take your leave.
The army is evicting Arabs from their homes in East Jerusalem, which Palestinians hoped to make their capital. Outraged, Arabs tried to save their homes, but the Israelis had the guns. Israel demolished more than 100 Arab homes in the past year, ruling they'd been illegally built. Arabs say this is just another tactic to drive them out.
It was another Friday morning. I was among the olive trees, out looking for birds to catch, my father, his friends, and me. I had my stringing net and a nimble eye there beside the farmer's field where the songbirds fly. When you're catching birds, the world disappears, and a thousand songs of autumn are all that fills your ears. They sing their songs so brightly at the dawning of the day. They fly back and forth over the fence where we must stay away. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings, listen to the wind and the songbird sings. It's so good to come here, so far from all the sound of all the shooting and the shouting and the tanks upon the ground. I just wish I could live here beside this olive grove, just me, my friends and family, and a small wood-burning stove. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings, listen to the wind and the songbird sings. Last week I caught 3 sparrows, it was quite a day. Now I'm bound for glory, that's what they say. I can hear them talk about me, shedding tears upon a sack. Inside there lies a child with 4 bullets in his back. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings. Listen to the wind and the songbird sings. You can see the birds beneath the clouds, watch them spread their wings. Listen to the wind and the songbird sings.
me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could?
Closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Seeing Red Radio.
Your enemy is ruling your country. And war is what they got.
If you tell us to make the world safe for democracy, we will take you seriously. And by God and by Christ, we will make it so.
There's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down, and the rich have won.
Seeing Red.
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
Radio. With a revolutionary socialist perspective.
Seeing Red.
The menace to our lives does not lie on the other side of a no man's land set apart without our consent. It lies within our own boundaries here.
We will wage the war that has to be won.
Featuring headlines from the front lines of the international class war.
We must be prepared to match actions with words.
Seeing Red Radio brings you the news that the corporate news media actively suppresses.
Give us the slogans. We'll turn them into realities. Sing the battle hymns, and we'll pick them up where you left off.
By seeking out every creative method of protest possible.
We feature the latest from the struggle of working class people to achieve what they rightly deserve from the international ruling class that steals from them each and every day.
Help! 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 I've been robbed! Help! I've been
That's
robbed!
That's Seeing Red Radio.
I've been robbed by the capitalist system!
Available every Thursday from 8 until 9 p.m. right here at Value Free Radio, WXOJLP. Northampton.
The struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the earth and the machinery of production, and abolish the wage system.
Was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles. We're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. Somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons, the Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air, and Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square, and they talked about what they do now after the Left their bases, went back to their families. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. George Bush and Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks. Organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. All the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11, home beneath the covers. And I learned how to play the accordion after the revolution.
Well, that wraps up this edition of Seeing Red Radio with a great song by David Rovix called After the Revolution. Thank you, Dave. Man, always some great stuff. Makes me feel good and lets us know what it is we're really fighting for here, folks. You know, as we look at the perilous journey that planet Earth seems to be set on, and we ask ourselves how it is we're going to get out of it, really hard to imagine that capitalism is going to do it, frankly. Because the contending powers that be have really very little interest beyond making profit. And they have absolutely no problem taking things to their own advantage. So if we're going to get our own advantage, if we're going to enjoy that glorious day that David Rovix just sang about, it's time to organize. It's time to get together. It's time to give capitalism that resounding final push over the cliff. Of Seeing Red Radio, we come to you every Thursday right here on Valley Free Radio from 8 until 9 o'clock. If you're interested in sourcing any of the articles you've heard, or if you're interested at all in finding out some of the music, check out our website at seeingredradio.org. You'll have a complete list. Also, you can tune in to all the past podcasted episodes, as well as subscribe to future podcasts. That's all on seeingredradio.org.